community members to sign their. This is the April 20th meeting of the JSR 2 meeting.
Good, are we on? You're taking, okay. Going to, change the agenda a little bit. First, what I'd like to do is do a tap-tap on House Bill 3229. We'll call this hearing to order again on House Bill 3229. We'll tap that bill out. The next item on the agenda is Senate Bill 1166. Call that hearing to order. Would you like to talk about 1166? Jane Wilkinson, would you like to come forward? Good afternoon. No. Take test. Would you like to come forward?
Good afternoon, Chairman Nedgerly, members of the committee. I'm Jean Underhill Wilkinson with the Oregon Cattlemen's Association. Fortunately, the some amendments for Senate Bill 1166 were just finished by Legislative Council, so we were looking at them just now.
I'm just looking at them right now.
You know the rule.
There is a rule, but there's no penalty.
Are all the phones turned off in the room?
I'd never get called.
that's a pizza card.
Hardly ever get called.
Go ahead.
All right. I know there was some controversy last time we met as to this bill. I know that I probably haven't alleviated all the potential controversy surrounding statutory definition of outstanding resource waters, but we tried to alleviate as much as possible. Also, there was some confusion as to our proposed amendments last time, which were not put in Legislative Council. Well, now they are, and it should be very clear what we're trying to do here. I think Legislative Council did a good job in making this a lot more clear and putting it in a different area of the statute, and in fact not providing a definition of high-quality waters and outstanding waters, but instead giving some standards as to what the Environmental Quality Commission must find in order to designate waterways as outstanding resource waters. So on the amendments, on page 2, you will essentially see the entire idea of what we're proposing. It says, in order to designate any waters of the state as outstanding resource waters, the commission must find at the time of designation and given current levels of development and economic activity on that waterway, the waters are high-quality waters that constitute an outstanding state or national resource because the waters are essentially pristine, exceed all applicable water quality standards, provide extremely high-quality and very productive aquatic habitat, support wild, native, and endemic fish species, and are among the top 5% of water bodies in Oregon with respect to the qualities described in this subsection. Now, As we went over before, and we don't need to go over it again, all the concerns surrounding the designation of outstanding resource waters, because this is not a management issue. This is not a management designation where we're trying to work around uses of our natural resources and environmental protection, and we're trying to manage the natural resources given human activity. That's not what this designation is about. This designation is about ultra super protection with absolutely no uses allowed around the water body. That's what this designation is for. So in carrying out the Oregon plan, I don't think that restricting statutorily the designation of outstanding resource waters, I don't think it jeopardizes carrying out the Oregon plan at all, because we need to preserve this type of designation to the best water body and make sure that only those are designated. Otherwise, we might have in the future real problems with not only agriculture or ranching around the streams, but or in watersheds, but also industrial uses, cities, and everything. We may run into big problems if this outstanding resource water designation is not limited as it should be.
Thank you. Any questions, Representative King?
In the amendments, I'm not understanding clearly whether the A through E are all the above or any of the above.
Representative King, I think that you could read it to say it would be all of the above because it's separated by semicolons, except on D, there is an and, which would mean that water bodies, in order to be designated, have to fit all those criteria. I think you could read it that way.
That's my understanding. Thank you.
Pete?
I just kind of did all what she said. I just saw the amendments. She's done a good job of clearing up the confusion prior. For the record, Pete Tess, Oregon Farm Bureau Federation. I think it pretty well tells what we want to do with this and try to avoid getting into the kind of situation that we're in with wild scenic rivers with something that's not retroactive, which will not allow retroactive activities on streams. It's particularly a problem beyond where that stretch of river may exist or water may exist, because anything in the uplands or in the watershed from mountainside to mountainside that might affect this river would be controlled and under some sort of watchful eye beyond which would normally happen. So that's the major concern as we see it. Thank you.
Any other questions? Comments? Representative Thompson?
I'll pass here for a minute.
Okay.
Is there other...
Yes. Okay, thank you very much. Mike Dweller.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Mike Llewellyn. I'm administrator of the Water Quality Division with DEQ. I, too, have had about 3 minutes to look at this amendment, and I know that I've testified several times in front of this committee on this ORW issue. So if you'll bear with me, Mr. Chair, I'll just try to give you an initial reaction. I think that the amendments here are still problematic to us at DEQ. The one specific issue that I've got is paragraph 5, subset E, that relates to a water body being in the top 5% in the state. There's no metric against which we can make a determination of a water body being in any percent in the state. So just trying to figure that out in and of itself, I think, would lead to a lot of confusion. I'm also concerned about the fact...
Representative Leonard,
where are you at again? I'm sorry, Mike.
I'm sorry.
Are you looking at the amendment or the bill?
Yes. Page 2, line 17.
Oh,
of the amendment.
Line 25.
Line 27. Mm-hmm.
Okay.
And as I think I mentioned when I testified on the original bill, one of the concerns that we still have is that it gets at Representative King's question that all these water bodies must meet all of these tests. It's my understanding that Crater Lake, which is often used as an example of a potential ORW, does not have wild, native, and endemic fish to it. So I still believe that while I understand that there's concern about trying to put some sideboards around the ORW definitions, that this is still much too limiting and just opens up a lot of questions about definitions like the term essentially pristine. I think people could challenge what that means. The final thing I'll say, Mr. Chair, is this bill is counter to the governor's executive order that's directing DEQ to evaluate whether ORWs would be an appropriate tool to bring to bear on some of the critical habitat for endangered salmon. So I'll leave it with that and be glad to answer any questions.
Okay. Any questions, comments, Mr. Lalova?
I do have a question. Mr. Lalova, the governor's executive order may be responsible for bringing this bill forward. I mean, the issue is to try to get some sort of a balance between an executive order that creates a sense of uncertainty about what waters are outstanding or remarkable and of the kind of resource values that we all agree that ought to be protected, and some systematic approach that would give reasonable people the same answers if they looked at the same set of information. And I guess there's a feeling of frustration that we don't have some better understanding about what is actually meant by outstandingly remarkable values or outstanding resource waters. I guess I would regard it as helpful if the agency would have some better recommendation than a reminder that this is contrary to the executive order.
Mr. Chair and Senator Ferrioli, I understand the issue that this has been a very difficult and complex definitional problem as well. And we are, again, I'd like to remind the committee, we have not designated one water body in this state as an ORW. And I think that what we need to try to go through is take a look at the draft screening criteria that our work group came up with, see whether or not that makes sense once we get to some specific water bodies, hold a full discussion on specific water bodies if they merit this type of ORW, and then see whether or not we need to provide more definition to these terms.
Mr. Lowe, what is the time frame that your department is doing this work?
Mr. Chair, we've committed to try to run at least the COHO core areas, which was the original process that was identified in the NIMS State of Oregon MOA that has been superseded by the executive order, to get those identified by June of this year. But we're not going to be moving ahead on any ORW designations until at least the end of the year to also look at other ESA-related streams pursuant to the executive order. So we're probably still 7 or 8 months away from having even a list of proposed water bodies that would make it through the screening criteria that our task force identified. We're still several months away from even having some water bodies.
Representative Thompson?
Well, I guess back on this question here, the 5% water bodies, is there any way to assess this 5% at all? I mean,
Mr. Chair, Representative Thompson, I really honestly can't say that there is, that I'm aware of. We're trying to compare water bodies that may meet all of these criteria, but you might end up with, let's say, the Salmonberry River that meets all of these particular tests. Compare it to, let's say, the Metolius River. But I don't know how you would then say that's within the top 5% of the 114,000 stream miles in the state of Oregon. We just don't have a full database to evaluate this against. It's a problematic to me. I just can't come up with a way to put it into definition of percent of water bodies that might meet this test.
Mr. Chair, could I ask one of the previous people the same question since they wrote the bill? Is there a way to do it?
Okay, you want it? Jane, could you come up and if you'd like to remark to that?
Representative Thompson, again, my name is Jean Underhill-Wilkinson with the Cattlemen's Association. The way that criteria reads is that I feel like, of course, it would be up to DEQ to interpret what it says, but my personal opinion is that DEQ would have to come up with a database, if you will, of potential water bodies that are going to meet the criteria, rather than what stream by stream by stream, and you know that quite a few streams are going to be petitioned to be designated as outstanding resource waters, rather than stream by stream designating those, deciding perhaps that they meet the criteria and designating those, which might end up to be a huge amount of streams, a large quantity of streams in the state, ultimately designated. Rather than doing that, DEQ would have to evaluate all the streams that potentially might fit this criteria and only designate the best of the best of those streams. The top 5% of those streams that may fit the criteria would actually be designated and given that super protection that would virtually allow no uses that may degrade the water body.
Thank you, Chair. Well, let me ask a question. Do you mind the both of them? If this was to be passed and this 5% was in there, and since there is no way to assess exactly what 5% is, would this create a lot more lawsuits, or would it open up the door for lawsuits for anyone to say, you know, this isn't 5%, and then there's no system to control what 5% is?
Representative Thompson, I think that with the current system that DEQ has now, the current outstanding resource program that DEQ is putting together, because of the criteria that is included there, I think that is opening floodgates for massive amounts of litigation because of the non-discretionary standard that DEQ has to put on these waterways that are designated. Because there's so much at stake when designating, that's going to create a massive amount of litigation. On the other hand, courts will probably have a tendency to give quite a bit of discretion as to how DEQ interprets how they apply the program that they're putting together now or how they would interpret these statutory standards. So I can't guarantee there won't be any litigation, but 5% of water bodies that meet the criteria, to me, that's fairly clear.
Well, we're not in work session, are we?
No.
Then I'll just let it stand.
Did you want to respond to that, Mike?
Mr. Chair, Representative Thompson, I can't comment really whether this would generate litigation. I think it would just generate a lot of argument about whether or not these water bodies are within 5%. People will argue about what essentially pristine means. So I think there'd be more consternation before we ever got to litigation about just the definition.
Representative King?
I'm a lot of background issue, but I'm sensing that, you know, something was created that's potentially very broad sweeping, and a lot of people are afraid of, you know, dramatic code over regulation, and we're trying to get some handle in terms of, you know, what does it mean? Taking Kinzer River, for example, and let's say that, you know, it's pretty well all qualified. But at some point in time, so that water seems suitable for a candidate to be high. So, you know, you talk to the candidate and the candidate is dependent upon the high quality of water. You know, if you're protecting the river, are you protecting the whole river, or are you protecting the mileage, you know, where you have fish population?
Chairman Meserly, Representative King, Mike Llewellyn might be able to answer that question, but as far as I know, with the program that DEQ is currently putting together, the petitions for designation of outstanding resource waters will come in and not necessarily request the entire waterway to be designated. It will request that petitions may request various segments to be designated. And this particular piece of legislation would not prohibit someone from coming in and petitioning a particular segment of a water body to be designated that may fit the criteria versus another segment that may not be a high-quality water portion and may not fit the criteria.
Mr. Chair and Representative King, I think the issue would be that if we designated an ORW that was, let's say, focused on the value of, critical habitat, high-quality water for a particular fish, it would, I think the petition would need to be very specific about the scope of that water body, the length of the stream, what the specific value is compared to other values, and then limit the management plan that would have to be developed to control whatever pollutants might impact that particular stream segment. I don't believe that the concept of ORW was ever meant to be applied to an entire watershed. a large landscape is to be specific to particular stream segments for a very specific value.
Senator Tarnow?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mike, and I think I heard you say that you had a work group discussing this issue. And I'm wondering, during the course of that discussion, if you looked at the connection or disconnection between outstanding resource waters and the 303D list. You heard us before, we said before, that if a water is considered to be 303D quality, water quality limited, then it probably should not be eligible for listing under outstanding resource waters. Have you folks taken a policy stand on it yet?
Mr. Chair and Senator Turner, yes, we have. We agree that a water body that is on the 303D list should not be eligible for an outstanding resource water. I should clarify, however, there's a lot of folks who disagree with that policy of ours.
Can I make one comment? Chairman Mezzerly, Senator Turner, I guess I need to add in there that some of EPA personnel does not agree that water bodies that meet all the water quality standards are the only water bodies that can be designated. There's disagreement on that, and in fact, I think there was a little bit of confusion within DEQ what policy position to take on that. DEQ does have the flexibility in the future to change their current regulations to allow themselves to potentially designate water bodies as outstanding resource waters, even if they're listed under the 303B list. So that's why it is a concern for us if we could nail that down in statute so that we make sure that water bodies that aren't meeting water quality standards are not designated. That would be preferable.
Any other questions?
I have a question.
Co-Chair Ferriola.
This is for Mike Llewellyn. Mr. Llewellyn, the designation requirement for outstanding waters has been on the books for how long?
Mr. Chair, Senator Ferrioli, I believe DEQ adopted rules in the early 90s, I think 1991.
Mr. Chairman, the thing that's frustrating to me, I think, is the testimony that Oregon Trout brought on this issue earlier, and that was that they were as frustrated as anybody because we don't have a system of designations that have been defined or that anybody understands as it seems to work. And in 9 years, there have been no designations. It's not that I'm anxious to see a lot of designations. It's just that there should be a much more easily applicable policy at the state level for making designations of outstanding values in water. That ought to be easily understood by people. That ought to be values that can be applied and understood by average people. I think if we're looking for the best of the best, that speaks to a self-limiting kind of quality. And the bill at least seeks to try to put some parameters around essentially what's been an unanswerable question from the agency standpoint. And I guess for me it comes down to a question of, if not fairness, at least accountability from the agency. You know, it seems to me that the landowners are not being fairly treated because they don't know what might be an outstanding value that would put additional restrictions on their management uses of land and water. And the environmental community is being treated unfairly because they have a right and a reason to expect that the best of the best of the waters of Oregon would be reasonably protected. So I guess I'm having trouble finding out who benefits by us not having a policy.
Mr. Chair, Senator Ferrioli, I don't have the personal institutional memory of the 9 years of debate on this. My understanding is that roughly in 1995, the agency was prepared to come forward to the Environmental Quality Commission with a list of water bodies for proposed designation. There was still consternation on the part of all the parties about some of the definitions that were used and what people call screening criteria to try to make sense of which water bodies would sort of fall through this sieve. That was unfinished business that we picked up last year when the petition was brought forward by several environmental groups to EQC and also driven by the NIMS State of Oregon MOU that called for DEQ to look at ORWs for the Coho core areas. So we brought a lot of folks back together. Gene was on the group and a number of others to try to pin down the screening criteria that would try to answer once and for all at least what some of the specific sideboards would be on designation. And I think it'd be fair to say that there was not a lot of agreement among the various stakeholders in that room. But what we tried to do at this point is to come up with some screening criteria, as I've mentioned. We're going to run the Coho core areas against those screening criteria, the petitioned water bodies that came forward last December, and then go back to this work group and say, here's what comes out of this sieve. Now that we have a little bit more definition of which specific water bodies we're talking about, does this make sense, and should we go forward to the EQC with designation? So I share your concern that this has been very difficult and complex and value-laden, and we are trying to put some parameters around the debate. I understand the frustration.
Chairman, I think we either, and maybe this is not the appropriate time to go into a work session on this bill since the amendments are just, I think the ink is still wet on the amendments. But it seems to me that we either ought to have a designation and if the agency can't or won't, that the legislature ought to make some designation, and if the agency or if the legislature is unwilling to make a designation, we ought to repeal the sections in the Oregon statutes that require the designation because nobody's doing it anyway.
There you go. You're very clear on that. Anyone else have any comments? Thank you very much. We are scheduled for a work session, but as the co-chair stated, I'd rather hold this over. We also need a fiscal report from Ken Rocco. So with that, we'll close the hearing on 21 on 1166, and we're going to open the hearing on House Bill 2103. And and I'd like the staff to update us on this one.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. If you'll remember, House Bill 2103 actually was borrowed to us by the House Water and Environment Committee. It would, in fact, extend the fish endowment account and that program. Instead of sunsetting in June of this year, it would extend the sunset to the year 2005. And it does have an emergency clause. It's my understanding that Ways and Means does need this as a piece of the ODFW budget, and they would like to see this keep moving. So our action today would be relative to moving it back to the original committee that has actual possession of the bill, that's House, Water, and Environment, and then from there it would be moved to Ways and Means.
Do we have physical possession of the bill now?
Mr. Chair, Senator Duke, this was one of the discrepancies in the House and Senate rules. I understand that on the Senate side they do not borrow bills, but because we are a joint committee, we are allowed to borrow bills from the House side, and that's what's happening here.
But I thought when you borrowed it, the original committee still
And that's exactly what will happen. It will go from here as a recommendation back to House, Water, and Environment. They will need to take formal action.
But they can't unless we do something?
Correct. Because
that's strange rules.
Okay.
Isn't that true that we can take no action and simply pass it back to the recommendation?
Hey, I assume so. You can probably do almost anything here.
Mr. Chairman, I understand that Mr. Rollator has to come up and say a few words. The man do have a motion.
Mr. Rollator.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Joe Rollator. I'm the Assistant to the Director of Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife.
I've got a memo here from you. Would you like to speak to the bill?
This is one of our agency bills we requested prior to the session. What this bill does is it extends the sunset on our fish endowment fund, which was created in 1989 as a way to have a long-term hatchery maintenance funding mechanism for our department. Half of the interest that we make on the wildlife fund, which is essentially our checking account, goes into the fish endowment fund. And the interest that the fund itself accrues also goes into this fund. The fund is to be held in reserve until we can use the interest on the fund itself for hatchery maintenance. When this bill was originally conceived in 89, interest rates were much higher. Our ending balance on our wildlife fund was much higher. It was expected that in 5 to 8 years, the fund would have enough money in it that the interest would be about $1.5 million a year, a biennium. That has not occurred. We ask that this fund be extended. Just for your information, half of the interest on our wildlife fund, which is essentially, as I said, our checking account for the next biennium, would be $171,000. And the fund, the interest on the fund itself would be $318,000. So roughly $500,000 would be available as earnings or interest into this fund during the next biennium.
Okay. Any questions, Senator Dukes?
Well, what do you plan to do with the money?
Eventually, Representative Messley, Senator Dukes, it was the plan of the legislature when they established the Restoration and Enhancement Fund that this Fisheries Endowment Fund would be used for hatchery maintenance, and it would be a long-term, the capital would be held in an account that was an interest-generating account, and the interest from that Fish Endowment Fund would be used for hatchery maintenance.
But didn't I hear you say you're going to have about $500,000, so that's the projection?
Mr. Chair, Senator Dukes, the way the fund was conceived of, half of the interest from the wildlife fund, which is essentially our checking account,
mm-hmm.
and the interest that the present principal in the Fish Endowment Fund generates is approximately $500,000. Under the current proposal, and if this bill is extended, we would not spend any of that money. It would go into the Fish Endowment Fund.
About how much would be available to spend on hatchery maintenance?
Mr. Chair, Senator Dukes, I'm assuming that your question means when the fund is finally at its full value of about $8 million.
Well, we don't get anything out of it until it hits $8 million?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Dukes, that's correct. Under the way the 1989 legislature conceived of this program.
Well, you keep closing hatcheries and clubbing fish, we probably won't have any need for it by then, though.
That's mild. That's mild.
Mr. Chairman,
I thought I was having a bad day. Are we still having fun? Representative.
Well, I guess to answer Senator Duke's inquiry, when we, and Joe and I have talked about this, so, you know, when we first heard this in water, what occurred to us at that point in time was that at the current rate that we are accumulating money in that fund, to get to the point where we would be able to invest $500,000 back into hatcheries would take us another 10 to 15 years, something like that. But what the amount of money that Joe just mentioned was the interest off of the current fund plus the amount of money that they would be putting into the fund is about $500,000. And so I think where we're heading with this is to kind of freeze that fund as is, and for a period of time, I think we're talking 4 years, sunset it at 4 years, to take those two pots of money and invest them in hatcheries, and then 4 years from now, if indeed economies have changed to where it makes more sense to have the reinvestment into the fund, we should go back to that. So, and that's probably
what you didn't say was we can make recommendations from this committee to the bill, but we can't actually amend it. So that's the recommendation I brought down here from the other committee, which I happen to sit on, and I will also take back to that committee when I go back. So,
Representative King and then Morgan. My tack is along the line of where I think Senator Dukes was going, and maybe not, I'll speak for myself, but I think that the cost of doing hatchery work has probably gone up a lot faster than that investment fund. And that the value of the investment in hatchery programs, assuming there's some justification for it, you know, far outstrips, and the pace that we get from that far outstrips the value of, quote, investment returns. I think we're going backwards on this thing, from an investment standpoint, an asset, and probably even a big picture policy standpoint. And pull the plug.
Representative Morgan?
I, along with Representative Cruz, have had the privilege of looking at this bill several times in Water Committee, and the conclusion that we've come to is that the rate that the fund is invested at is too low to actually generate enough interest to grow the fund at a rate where it's going to have any meaning. And I think that the solution that Representative Cruz came up with, where we're actually taking what we're putting into the fund each year from the portion of surcharges on the licenses, combined with what we can take out of the fund in earnings, does make a good contribution towards maintaining the hatchery system, and then putting the 4-year sunset on it gives us time to come back again and take a look at the whole program when we're ready to address the hatchery issue in a more comprehensive kind of a way.
Just to speak to Representative King's pull the plug concept, because we did think about that. And the reason we didn't go there was simply because there's so much confusion about hatchery programs right now. We thought if we kept that fund intact, because $3 million would be a pretty decent investment in hatcheries if we had some certainty where we're going with the program. So as long as we keep that fund intact, if we ever do get to the point where we've made determinations about wild fish policy and we've made determinations about the value of hatcheries, then we could invest that fund in a more certain manner. Certainly the $500,000 towards maintenance doesn't go very far, but it goes farther than what we're doing currently.
Any other comments from the committee? Questions? Sheriff Barrioli?
Mr. Chairman, I would move. We have to go into the session now.
Close the hearing and open the session on House Bill 2103.
Mr. Chairman, I would move to send HB 2103 back to the House Water and Environmental Committee without recommendation.
You've heard the motion. Any discussion of the motion? Representative Jensen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. What is that?
I may have misspoke. I said without recommendation. Thank you.
Is there any other comments? Any opposition to the motion? Not so ordered. Open the hearing on House Bill 3225, and we have one sign up to testify, Mr. Eric Carlson.
Mr.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Land, members of the committee, my name is Eric Carlson. I'm coordinator of the Clackamas River Basin Council. I am here today testifying for myself, basically, because I haven't had a chance to talk to my council about this. I see that there are now -5 amendments. I did an analysis of the draft that was prepared by the Natural Resources Work Group. A number of the sections have changed. Rather than testify on the -5 amendments without being able to refer you to sections, I think I'll go back and redo my analysis and come back another day.
Okay. Thank you very much. Yes. Representative Thompson.
I guess I've got some questions. I mean, -5 is here. I assume this is the analysis. Now, for some of us who haven't been privileged to the internal workings of this committee, would you mind explaining to us exactly where we're going now? I thought we were at the -2 amendments, and that was what we were working off of. Now, all of a sudden, I hear -5 amendments are what we're working off of.
Right. We've been discussing with my co-chair and several people around the building just today and trying to figure out how to proceed from this point on. And I would like to spend some time this afternoon discussing with the whole committee of how we should walk our way through this. I think that one thing I'd like to discuss and like to recommend is that as far as the Natural Resource Office, that's really a separate issue. That's a policy group that belongs to the governor's office. And really, I think it's confusing any progress we make moving forward. We've got other issues such as the ballot measure 66 itself and the definitions and where the funds would go and those kind of things. I think we should be focusing on that. We also, I think, should be focusing on GWEB, the structure of GWEB, where it's managed, whether it's in its own agency, a new commission, or whether it's placed within departments such as water resources. And this is what I'd like you to discuss here this afternoon on the committee. I think we've had testimony from several people, from all the different groups, from the watersheds to the fisheries to the landowners and the natural resources, and that probably the most efficient way for us to move forward at this point is to simply go into work sessions and work out and just work in all the details. And put our package together. We don't have a lot of time, and I would like staff to remind us and go through our time frame that we have, that leadership has asked us to complete our work here on this committee. But I don't believe it's that we're operating in a vacuum. I think we've heard, if anything, we've been overwhelmed with information and testimony. And we just simply need to go to work and get through it.
Well, I agree. You're probably not working in a vacuum, but if you put yourself as being in a minority party that hasn't been privileged to any of the backroom conversations, and I mean this respectfully, we see amendments keep popping up and new bills keep popping up, and I can't wrestle with amendments to the amendments when I don't know what the original amendments are. And so at some point, we need to say, this is where we're going, so that the minority party has a chance to make input into the process. So far, there's no place in this process for the minority party to have any input into it, and time's running out.
Staff, would you like to run us through what our work schedule is?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. We need to, by the end of this month, get through basically all of our bills and send them off to their appropriate chamber for their first hearing on the floor. By virtue of the fact that we're a joint committee, that deadline is April 30th for us, April 29th, because that's our last meeting date before that deadline. Because we're a joint committee, any substantive bills crossing either floor come back to this committee, are reassigned to this committee before they move to the second chamber. So we do function as that second chamber check in this process. For that reason, we actually the policy pieces that don't go immediately to Ways and Means can then be worked, continue to be worked in this committee until May the 19th. So that would actually extend our working time 3 weeks on the policy pieces if the committee chose to go that way. That is, send the fiscal pieces on to fiscal so we don't hold up Ways and Means. We want to be sensitive to that. With a hook into the policy piece, which that would be one strategy that we could use to be able to have more time for discussions and make sure the members are comfortable with the proposal being moved forward.
Question or Thompson?
Well, here again, I'm dealing in a vacuum. And when a bill normally comes forward and you have these chances of amendments, and I understand Ways and Means, I hear rumors around the Capitol that Ways and Means has spent part of this money. And if I don't know if it's true or not, but it concerns me that part of this money was spent and we never had any point of input from the minority party.
Co-chair, would you, since you're the chair of outline your schedule.
That, I think we refer to that as a lateral arabesque, Mr. Chairman, and well done, I might admit. I think the rumors that we're all hearing are probably grounded in fact, and it has a lot to do with the co-chair's decisions about backfill, and it has a lot to do with the issues that we're all wrestling with about where we were, which was with an Oregon plan that was focused on not getting a listing, and now moving forward into this legislative session with an Oregon plan that's focused on watershed improvements. There hasn't been a transition between those two issues. And we did create a lot of folks that are out there with the ear tag of salmon restoration in various agency bills. And those folks are doing the activities that reasonably would be done under Measure 66. And the choices are to lay them all off and then create those positions anew under Measure 66 or move them under the umbrella of Measure 66. And those are some of the discussions that have been going on. And that, I think, is what you've been hearing and what I've been hearing and some of the discussions that have been happening. The two things I can tell you about that is that those dollars were primarily all in administration. They're not in the project dollars that would go to the ground. We would probably end up needing to do the services under Measure 66 anyway. And there's been about 10 different configurations for possibilities, and most of them are being driven by the idea that the administrative costs are the places where the folks would move under the Measure 66 umbrella. The dollars that we want to go to the watershed councils come from the 65% that were earmarked for on-the-ground projects, and there's no allocations of dollars within that fund. It's a total amount that we're trying to move in that direction, and my assumption is that those things would go through the same winnowing process they did when we put money, the $30 million, into GWEB processes and got those dollars to the ground. So I think, Representative Thompson, to answer your question, Mr. Chairman, through the chair to Representative Thompson, there is going to be some backfill. We've been very honest about that from the first day. We've found it in the governor's budget. We've found it in the president's budget. The backfill has to come from somewhere, and it has to go to somewhere. And you know, the focus now is on the administrative issues, and there those reasonable and legitimate functions that fit under the constitutional requirements for Measure 66. So that's what I've been hearing. That's what you've been hearing. There is going to be some of that. I don't think there was any mystery about how that had to happen. So
I just want to clarify first, Representative Thompson, that when Senator Ferraioli talked about the co-chairs, he was not talking about that.
Oh, no, he's actually talking about the Ways and Means, Chairman.
Yes. Point of clarification, staff.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, just as a reminder, The actual allocations are the purview of the Ways and Means Committee. This committee has the jurisdiction to deal with the policy end of that, and that is grant criteria and those sorts of policy pieces that will influence the spending of that money, but the actual allocations we will not wrestle with here. We will only deal with the policy pieces like definition of capital expenditures, grant criteria, that sort of thing. Mr. Chair?
I'd like to make sure I answered Representative Thompson's question.
I think so. I'll let the other members of the party all
wait. Mr. Kircher, my door is always open.
Are you there?
Senator Duke.
Two pieces. One, Ways and Means doesn't know where to put the Measure 66 money until we're finished with this bill, because we decide what the fund is and who's got it, so they don't know where the money's going to go. Now, the parks budget is already at a subcommittee. Decisions were made down there about that. And actually, Representative Thompson, in his own inimitable way, has a good point. I stumbled into a Measure 66 meeting with us to leave. So there has been a little exclusion.
Representative King, on to your efforts to reorganize this, I think that we've bid enough whether we can chew in the time allowed for where the dash twos were. I haven't had a chance to see that dash fives yet. I assume that there's some paring down along the lines of what you described. I do feel, however, that largely councils are an exception to the amount of input we've had. We have heard from watershed councils. We've had some comment from them on 3225 that it was, on a hurry up. It was with limited information, and now we've got another amendment in place. And whereas I do feel that we've got quite a bit of information from other groups, I personally still feel we're short of the watershed input on into what we're dealing with enough time to respond on a non-moving target. So I would like to have a chance to hear from, some representation, not just one, but, a perspective from them. Thank you.
I think what we need to discuss here this evening is that how do we move forward from this point? Do we develop and appoint another work group and with a broader base to go and put a package together, or do we go into work sessions ourselves and develop a package ourselves and then go to have another public hearing on that?
Mr. Chairman, could I ask you for a point of clarification, or at least Judith for a point of clarification before we get to that question?
Sure.
I was I was a little surprised to see dash fives myself.
Thank you.
So my question to Judith was, well, we were working on dash twos, what happened to dash threes? I sometimes nod off in these meetings, but I think I appear to be reading things that nobody else is told. Dash three was a placeholder.
Yes, the dash three amendments were a placeholder that Jeanette developed, and they actually are separate and distinct from anything we're talking about here. And also, the dash four amendments is a bullfrog amendment, and I didn't want to confuse the mix here, but we are proposing to name bullfrogs as an invasive species, and this and 3225 was the only relating to clause, because we couldn't do it under the 3071 Representative Thompson's creating a new crime. That is where that fits. So there are indeed no other Measure 66 concepts floating around out there, even though you see the gap between the dash twos and dash fives.
Sure. So, Mr. Chairman, I was curious about the dash threes, and apparently the dash threes have somehow gotten sucked into the dash fours that relate to bullfrogs. And if we haven't seen the dash fours, they are related to invasive species. Dash threes, I guess, somehow transmogrified it into dash fives, and so.
So
we're all seeing the same. We're all seeing the same ones, but I am really anxious to see the bullfrog amendment.
Well, that's why they call it the bullfrog amendment. It jumps from two to
forward.
Jensen, excuse me.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a point of clarification on the dash fives. Are those basically legislative council's rewrite of the measures that we heard on Saturday?
Yes.
thank you. Mr. Chair, Representative Jensen, that is correct. And at your speech, I did very quickly, so I hope that I didn't miss anything, but I did do a quick comparison. When I received the Dash 5s out of council today, this is the official council draft, exactly true, codifying the concepts that were brought forward in the proposal on Saturday. And you will find a matrix. It looks like this at your seat, where I went ahead and tried to match up the sections so you could see the alternative proposals that you will need to think about.
And Representative Morgan.
Point of clarification, Jared, how does that relate to this one? Is anything on to this?
Correct. Mr. Chair, Representative Morgan, what you see in your binder from Saturday under legislation, that's what was turned into legislative council, and that's what Jeanette used to draft that proposal. That is the Dash 5. And then you will see then the matrix is the comparison between the Dash 2s and the Dash 5s to help you move back and forth between the two in your own thought process.
Representative Jensen. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And before, are we in
work session?
No, just here. Before we, you know, proceed with this again, lengthy and difficult task of going through and flipping pages, it was kind of my thought of what I was hearing earlier in the day. That we were going to go through and look at and identify the concepts that we were interested in working with, and so that we might have some at least vague idea of where we were going to go and how we were going to get there. Is that?
That's one thought, and we can also at some point accomplish the same thing by going through this matrix too as well. But I think it would be valuable for the committee just in general to talk about some of the concepts we've heard about.
And I don't have any problem with doing that per se, but unlike some of you, at least for me, it is takes a little time for me to digest these rather voluminous measures that we have before us, and before I come in and I'm going to be at least effective in doing that, I really need to have time to sit down with staff, my staff, and colleagues, and just kind of work my way through so that I have an idea of what each one is doing and how it's going at it.
Thank you. Representative Cruz?
Mr. Chair, I guess I'd say that, you know, we shouldn't feel too bad. We're still 42 amendments short of the charter school bill at this point.
Mr. Chairman, I'd like to further respond to Representative Thompson's earlier comment.
Co-Chair Ferriero.
Representative Thompson, I agree with you. I think we need to get more folks more engaged in this process. And the working group that was sort of an ad hoc group that came forward to try to build a framework and have, in fact, done these amendments, I think did a marvelous and an amazing job in a really short period of time. And again, I think this is another iteration of a framework document for discussion. I agree that we don't have enough input from watershed councils. We heard from two on Saturday, and that was only because we didn't have enough time to get more of them in. Some additional comments have come in writing. But I do think we need to get a whole bunch more input from watershed council folks, and there should be no, there's been no attempt to exclude people from this process, but we need to do a lot better job of communicating objectives and goals and moving through the process so that all the committee members have the same opportunity to comment. And if we haven't done that to this point, let's make sure that we do that from this point.
Representative Johnson.
And I appreciate that. There's been no attempt to exclude anybody, that's for sure. But the problem lies in what we're working on. I know that I'm becoming frustrated and seeing time run out because looking at both these, I would like to have amendments drafted to the amendments
or another set of amendments. I don't know what to do at this point. I mean, if you want us to draft another, get another work group and take off on our own to try to solve the problem, I'd be glad to do it, but I don't want to do it without the group's support, because we just see another amendment out here in fractions. I don't know. I need some idea what to do.
I'm a little confused, Representative. What could you express?
Well, there's sections in this amendment
that
just concern me. I guess what I need some guidance. Do you want me to go out and take this apart section by section and then come back and make my amendments to this amendment? How do you want me to proceed?
I think the most productive thing we could do right now is to move forward with our main bill, 3225,
okay,
and amend everything back into that. Otherwise, we're going to get just more and more confused.
Okay. That's what I wanted to know.
And that's what I want the discussion here. If you get it, Chair, what I'm looking for is consensus amongst our committee.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Representative Leonard.
I'm just wondering if we could start out with some of the basics and begin by reaching some consensus on developing a skeletal structure to implement ballot measure 66, specifically address the issues of what that requires of us in terms of an oversight agency, who gets the money, and some of these other issues could be dealt with separately. But I think we could break this up into the issues that need to be dealt with because of ballot measure 66, and then have a separate discussion, if we want, about some of the other issues people may have interest in. I think it'd be a lot easier to look at it that way, just break this down to its simplest components, and start with an amendment that simply does what the ballot measure requires of us to do. That would be, for me, that would be the most helpful first step to take.
And I think that's what we're trying to accomplish here, is to break this thing down into pieces and move forward in those pieces. And we've had that presentation once early on, and maybe we need to refresher. Ken Rocco is here, and Jeanette, if you're watching the monitor, could you come down and maybe do that review course again right now?
I guess the Chair, my point is, I think the Dash 2 amendments and Dash 5 amendments go beyond what ballot measure 66 requires us to do, and that we should, I think, agree maybe amongst ourselves first. Let's do first what ballot measure 66 requires of us, and then if we have time, deal with those other issues.
Senator
Dukes, but I'd have a response to Representative Leonard.
Senator Dukes.
And I do, too. I think Senator Leonard is right, and it would be helpful if staff could identify those parts of both Dash 2s and Dash 5s that we have to do. And then if we can come to some consensus around that, we will have reached a major milestone in this, and then we can see if we want to go beyond that.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. To Representative Leonard's question, I think there are two constitutional requirements that we have to accomplish in the bill, and that's to designate or create a state agency, and that is to create a fund. And I think the draft legislation, I'm fairly sure, because those things were really obvious and needed things, are either in the computer, drafting section of the legislative council awaiting our direction, or they are actually in draft somewhere. So the point is, no matter what else we do, we have to create a fund, and the blank place would be, you know, what agency name you want to type in there, or the creation of the agency by statute. So those things, I think, could either move out of this committee as separate bills, or could be incorporated in as the first a couple of clauses of the framework bill that you're referring to. The other stuff that we're talking about, have been talking about and looking at, are essentially how do we move the money from this agency fund to the ground? And we know that in the last iteration, that was GWEB. Now, there's some questions and some concerns about how GWEB works. Some folks think that it works great. Other people had some real heartburn with the way it functioned, and there was some real friction during the interim with the oversight
committee. Well, Senator Farrell, by now we all get that.
I got it.
We all get that.
Right.
We've heard it.
Yeah.
We know it.
Yeah.
We get it, we've heard it, and we've heard it, and we've heard it. And I think some of us on this side of the aisle and the governor's office are frustrated that the ballot measure 66 legislation in the form of House Bill 3225 is being attempted to be used as a vehicle to accomplish some other ends. I think what you're hearing Representative Thompson saying is, let's do what we have to do first, which is implement ballot measure 66, and let's take all of these other issues and deal with them as separate pieces of legislation if we want to, or let's discuss them in some other forum if you want to, and if you want to do that, let's make sure everybody's invited to have that discussion, and not just those that have an interest in using ballot measure 66 to accomplish some other end. But our job here is to implement ballot measure 66, and it would appear we're losing sight of that. And some of us are feeling like we should go home and mow our lawn instead of just sitting here, because I'll at least have that done by tonight.
Senator Ferriero. I can see how that your assessment from your perspective, I'm sure, is absolutely right. All I can say is that the GWEB offers one tool, and if there's some improvements that we can make in GWEB, if we can enhance it in some way and make it work better, or if we can change it to a different configuration with what we think is more representation, then I think that is as much an obligation for this committee as any other. For instance, GWEB never did have tribal representation on it. GWEB had a number of the folks from the watershed councils, but there wasn't much representation, if any, of the saltwater conservation districts. There are more people engaged in the process than were represented by GWEB, by the Governor's Watershed Enhancement Board. And the other issue that we talked about and wrestled with at great length in the committee and public hearing is that we wanted something that extended past the life of any particular governor and past the life of any particular legislature. So some folks didn't feel GWEB was the proper mechanism. They've discussed enhancement of GWEB. You could call it a GWEB plus. They've also discussed a completely different organization that takes the best elements of GWEB and moves it forward into another. The other thing that was discussed was creating a commission as an alternative to it. So those things are all on the table. I do agree with you, Representative Leonard, through the chair, that the Governor's Natural Resource Office changing to the Oregon Natural Resource Office really isn't an issue dictated by Measure 66. And I think the co-chair mentioned earlier tonight that maybe that isn't a proper focal point for the legislation that we're considering to implement Measure 66.
If I could, Mr. Chair, I think the only point is it would make as much sense for the Democrats on this committee to meet with the Governor's Office and come up with a dash six set of amendments without including you and Representative Mesrelli. I heard somebody say that. It slipped out. I thought he's been referred to as Mesrelli and Farrioli.
Yeah,
that popped out of there. It would make as much sense for us to do that, come here with the dash six amendments, as it does for the majority party, to come forward with dash two amendments that don't include the governor's office. So that's where I think we're frustrated is, you know, there is, you know, another guy here that's going to have to sign off on this stuff, and we're not doing any end runs here. I mean, people should get that by now.
Okay.
No, let me respond first. We have had meetings with the governor's office. Probably could have had more, but that's one of the reasons we've been slow bringing this process forward, because we were trying to get some kind of an understanding at least where the governor is willing to go. Representative Jensen,
if I could just quickly suggest to Representative Leonard that if in fact they do this, that they don't come in with a dash six, they should come in with a dash eight.
Eight or nine.
Yeah.
Actually, Mr. Chairman, I really wish Representative Leonard had a dash six.
The table. Well, as a matter of fact, no.
You know.
Let me move to Representative Thompson.
Let me refresh for those of you who weren't on the Oregon Family Plan. This is the kind of challenge this was. A similar challenge. I mean, it seemed like an insurmountable task. But that's exactly what we did. in that case. We brought in the governor's office where they were at, and then we went into negotiations with the committee and went through section by section inside the committee and took that proposal to the level that became the salmon plan. And we just have to have something somewhere to work. And I did have something here, a note that was fascinating. I apologize for not, but I would like to share it with the committee if you don't mind. And I think it did bring to mind something that I forgot about. Doesn't Measure 66 say to designate an agency rather than create an agency? And could I ask one of our learned colleagues, is that correct? Is that the proper wording that was there?
Mr. Chair, Representative Thompson, Jeanette Holman from Legislative Council. Measure 66 requires the legislature to establish a fund, and it requires that on the restoration and protection part of that for salmon and other things, the fund is administered by a single state agency. So basically, you have to designate or create an agency to do that. You can do
it. You can create. Okay. Apologize.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to reiterate, there are other substantive pieces of legislation in these amendments, things that don't necessarily have anything to do with Measure 66, but have something to do with the whole broader salmon restoration piece. So that some of it really concerns me. But I also wanted to ask how you plan to handle this. I mean, Representative Thompson was just laying out sort of the working group, negotiation, substantive committee way of dealing with the Oregon Salmon Plan. What is your collective intentions on how we get from here to a bill?
I think that we need to, as a committee, co-chair, disagree if you'd like, just start working through the pieces and use 3225 as the basis that we can either fold in different testimony or amendments that we have, concepts.
Can we start with a blank piece of paper and take the pieces that we want in it and put them on that piece of paper?
Basically, that's what we would be doing here. What's that, Morgan? Are you on the list?
What I wanted to make is that it is clear that there are at least two separate things going on here. The first one of which is to designate the agency to receive the money and set the fund up. And that's pretty cut and dry, and I think we're far down the road in defining that. We've got some pretty substantive language. Not that there are very many issues there left to work out, and we could be done with that very quickly. The part that is going to take a lot of discussion and take a lot of time on the part of the members of the committee that want to become involved in it is to take advantage of the opportunity that we have here to look at this over the long term and in the big picture. And that's that we're going to be dealing in Oregon with the Clean Water Act and with the Endangered Species Act for a long time, for years and years and years. And we've got an opportunity here to set something up that transcends whoever it is that's sitting in the governor's chair, and it transcends whoever is sitting in the Senate and in the House. And it actually codifies what the Oregon plan is all about and how top of the system down to the ground, and how the accountability goes from the bottom of the system to the top of the system. And personally, I think to miss out on that opportunity that we have right here in time is to not do the citizens of Oregon a great favor and a great service. So we have an opportunity here to put something in place that really does serve the needs of the people and the needs of the fish and the needs of the environment, and to pass that up would be a real shame.
Senator Starr.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think now that everybody's had their opportunity to say what they think we should do, I think we should get to work. I would suggest that we work through this section by section, have all the players
here and able to give their opinions, and we thought we'd get to doing.
I wanted to point out that the things that Representative Morgan is talking about are worthwhile things to do, but they don't have to be done in this bill. We can create another bill to do them. We can do the basics and move that on. We can create another bill that will take, will allow us to take the time to chew those over and work them out.
Representative Thompson,
I'd like to make one last comment and apologize. This process so far has frustrated me very much to the point the other day where I was ready to walk off this committee and tell the speaker to remove myself from it after this much effort. And take a second, but it reminds me of what I do as a fisherman if I go get drunk at night. Because what I do, if you go get drunk at night, you got to go down to the boat. And there's a theory that the first thing you got to do is untie the boat. That's not true. The first thing you got to do is figure out which boat's yours. And that's where the... So now, we figured out that the day cruise is our boat.
I the sucker, and I agree with him. Get on with it.
Representative King and then Turtle.
I'm willing to go to work. I'm frustrated that we're not there, and I think that the people in the audience are pretty frustrated that we're, you know, kind of directionless here. I am doubtful, though. I think we have a vehicle, you know, that represents opportunity to be able to discuss things, and I think they need to be done. But I'm not convinced that we're at, quote, opportunity. If we were at the beginning of the session, I would argue very hard that we are at the beginning of opportunity and felt that optimism and, you know, some of it slipping. But that the 29th is a week away. I'm very skeptical that we, quote, have the opportunity to do the work to get where we're going to go and to have something that's going to be something that we've, you know, have done the process on and that we'll get through the governor at the same time and do the necessary homework. I'm just skeptical that a week is enough time. That's my opinion.
Senator Carl?
Mr. Chair, co-chairs, I think we ought to take the dash twos as a starting off point and go from there. I've briefly gone through the dash fives, and I think there's some concepts in there in the fives that are valid that we can add into the dash twos. But I think we ought to use the dash twos as a starting point.
Or Senator Morgan.
Just one comment on the time frame that I believe that we actually have until May the 19th before we have to pass this onto the floor of the second house that deals with it. So we actually have quite a bit more time than a week to work on it.
More than a week, but that time frame is going to shrink really fast.
Mm-hmm. Any other comments before we move on?
Representative Jensen.
Thank you. Speaking as someone who was a freshman in this body 2 years ago and who jumped in voluntarily to get in the middle of the creation of the salmon plan, and someone who came from the deserts of eastern Oregon without any idea of what a salmon was or why anyone would conceivably want to save them, the attempt to get the learning curve that was there, and the struggle that took place, as I saw it, between the one side of the house and the other side of the house, and between the body, the legislature, and the governor's office and the governor's staff. At about this point, I think in that time frame, I would have probably given pretty good odds that this body would have never come up with a salmon plan. And I share everybody's frustration with this, but I think the fact that we've finally gotten around to the point of being frustrated is an indication that we have, in fact, been involved in a very significant learning process. And we're probably at the point that if we can start to work on this, we can get something done in the time frame that we have to do it.
We're ready to go to work.
What I'd like to do is, between Jeanette and Ken, Section 8, which talks about establishment of the fund as well as the definitions, review for us. This is of the Dash 2s. Review for us where we are at this point. We've had a lot of discussion.
And you'll find that put in page 5 of the Dash 2 amendment.
Mr. Chair, Ken Rocco, Legislative Fiscal Office. Section 8 basically complies with the direction in the constitutional amendment to establish a Parks and Natural Resources Fund. The in this section, the Department of Administrative Services was identified as the agency to administer it, primarily because of its experience in distributing money to agencies from the larger Administrative Services Economic Development Fund. It's the larger lottery fund. And the monies going into this Parks and Natural Resources Fund, of course, are also lottery funds, and it is the intention of the legislature to continue to track these resources as lottery funds because of the way the budgetary system of the state of Oregon operates. So due to that kind of a structure, this agency was identified simply as a mechanism to distribute the money.
A lottery fund. Representative Starr, I think, has a question.
Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Chair. We recently passed the Parks budget out of the subcommittee in Ways and Means. The structure that budget was under is similar to what's represented here in Section 8, I assume. Is that correct? Can you?
Mr. Chair, Representative Starr, yes, the language that was included in the passing out of that budget is consistent with the language in this bill. In this section. In subsection 2 of that section, it just distributes the money from the Parks and Natural Resources Fund, or the largest fund, into two sub-accounts. And this is just an accounting mechanism to split those funds because the separate accounts have separate purposes. One purpose is for the park activities, which is the park sub-account, and the other is the restoration protection sub-account, which would be the vehicle for receiving the dollars on the for salmon restoration and water quality programs. And again, you'll see in subsection 5 that once again, the Department of Administrative Services has been identified as the agency to distribute the monies within that restoration protection sub-account, or basically filling that blank line that says a single agency will be identified. And this is not for any kind of policy oversight or programmatic reasons. It's just, again, a mechanism to allow the distribution of resources, since the plan is to provide those resources to a number of different entities.
I have a couple of questions, but before I recognize those representatives, what are the other options we have here? We could either do it, as you suggest, as this amendment suggests, to DAS, or we could set up a new agency, or we could put it into another agency, right?
Mr. Chair, yes. In the governor's proposed legislation that I think it's Senate Bill 321, identified the Governor's Watershed Enhancement Board as that agency, or the Water Resources Department, which GWEB is a part of, administratively a part of. So you could use an agency like that. You could use the Department of Fish and Wildlife. You could use the Department of Environmental Quality, or you could establish a new agency.
Senator King? Senator Carnell?
Mr. Chair, I wonder if we can resolve one issue this evening, if nothing else. And that's the issue of who shall maintain the funding mechanism for this program.
in the dash twos, it alludes to DOS. I personally have a problem with that, and I would like to recommend we continue the funding with GWEM as administered by Water Resources. Now, I don't know if you want to have a waiver motion or not, but I think it's an issue we need to bring to the table and resolve.
I'll second that. We're not in work session tonight, and we have to wait till Thursday before we can advertise as a work session. So, Senator Dukes?
I've been concerned from the beginning that the first agency that this money hits be simply a pass-through. Now, am I correct in assuming that the way this is drafted, that is that? And then it's broken into two sub-accounts. Because we have no expenditure limitation ability on the first agency. And that's DAS. And then it's broken into two sub-accounts, and we have limitation ability on the others. And in this case, the second agency is also DAS, but as Senator Tarno had suggested, it could be Water Resources, and we would have that expenditure limitation on it. Am I correct?
Yes. Mr. Chair, Senator Dukes, the limitation restriction is on the Parks and Natural Resources Fund. The legislature cannot limit the amount of dollars coming out of that fund. And so when that money flows into the two sub-accounts, it automatically goes into the sub-accounts. And the agency that makes that happen is the Department of Administrative Services. They will make that happen. And they are responsible for distributing lottery revenues to not only to the Parks and Natural Resources Fund, but also to the Education Endowment Fund and to all other agencies that receive lottery dollars under the lottery allocation bill that the legislature
And that's
passed.
The sub one.
Yes.
And now, does that qualify as the first agency that gets this money before we have to designate the original agency? Does that qualify?
I don't think in that sub one that has to be identified. Because that is something that would just be done as a means of transferring the money into the Parks and Natural Resources Fund, which I think most people assume is going to be the Department of Administrative Services. Yeah, that's because that's the function that they serve with the larger lottery funds.
Okay, so.
Senator Dukes, it's the second occurrence of the Department of Administrative Services that I think is in question, and that's what Senator Tarno was referring to, because that is the identification of the single agency in the constitutional amendment.
That's the one where there is some dispute over how much restriction we can place on it?
Mr. Chair, Senator Dukes, the question is, I believe, whether any restriction can be placed on the amount of dollars that are allocated out of that fund. The intention of the Dash 2 amendments would be to allocate, just as we pick a number now on the latest forecast before distributing lottery revenues in the lottery allocation bill, we would also anticipate a certain dollar amount based on that latest revenue forecast, probably the May forecast. And allocate that total amount of dollars into each one of these sub-accounts. And then out of that sub-account, the monies would be provided to different entities, perhaps to agencies for programs, perhaps to GWEB or whatever organization is created to do grant projects. And at that point, you can provide a limitation on an agency expending dollars. But you're not going to be able to limit the outflow of dollars from the grant fund because that's going to be the recipient of the bulk of these dollars.
The LC opinion seems to indicate that we can't prohibit them from spending it either. Just what I'm wondering is if we were to make Water Resources this second, first, whatever, agency, and we were to indicate to the budget that we wanted them to pass it on to a number of different agencies, and they were to decide that they wanted, the governor decided he wanted to do something differently with it. Is there any reason that they couldn't do something different with it?
Mr. Chair, I believe the problem comes in that agencies are required under Oregon law to have an expenditure limitation of funds that are not continuously appropriated to them.
But they can shift their expenditure limitation.
If they have enough limitation available, but it is without a ways and means to make sure that doesn't occur.
That's on your star, if you have questions. Any other discussion of this issue?
Just an observation, Mr. Chairman. It looks like the Section 8 in the Dash 2s is identical to the Section 33 in the Dash 5. Same language, identical.
That's Ann Thompson.
With the exception of you've moved, you just moved it around. You moved capital expenditures forward in the second version, listing in front. I mean, they're not identical.
But, well, that was in the form of a question, Representative Thompson. I'm just asking.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Do you have a comment to make, Jeanette or Shane?
Mr. Chair, I do have a point of clarification. The language, yes, is very similar, reflecting what the ballot measure says. But of course, in the dash twos, we have dash, and just so everyone knows exactly where we're at on the dash, in the dash twos, page 6, line 27 is where we're talking about what that single state agency, who that will be. And it's my understanding under the current system, as Senator Turner was speaking to before, in a sense, Water Resources Department serves that function where the money flows through them to the grant in GWEB. And so the options there are in the Dash 5 that they name the commission, this newly created commission, instead of Department of Administrative Services. So the policy question there is who that single state agency will be for those pass-through dollars.
Mr. Chair, the other part of that is that these in the Dash 5, it never goes through DAS. It goes directly to the commission.
Even the first dash?
Yes. They send it. Well, it's just distributed directly into the two sub-accounts from the state lottery.
Which?
Now, DAS, I assume, would be doing that behind the scenes, but
okay.
It's not in the legislation.
So we're basically talking about the same thing.
Mr. Chair, I think the primary difference is that the single agency, all of the money would be provided to the Oregon
Watershed
Conservation Commission in the Dash 5, and in the Dash, and then distributed in some fashion after that. And in the Dash 2s, it would be provided to the Department of Administrative Services, and then they would make the distribution based on legislative instruction. That's the primary difference between those two.
But it's going to happen the same way regardless, right?
Well, there is other language in the Dash 5 amendments, Mr. Chair, that would limit the ability of the legislature to provide certain direction on how that money would be expended.
Captain Jensen?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the purpose of, my perception of the way that we're going now, along with Senator Tarnow's comments that we kind of conceptually understand that it's Water Resource Department that we're talking about, recognizing that if at a later point we choose to name this something else or create something, then that plugs back in at this point. But we can't get hung up, if we're going to go through here, about what this other mythical sort of thing is. So that would be my hope of where we're going with this right now.
Good point. Representative Starr, did you have your hand up? Would you like to move on, Ken, first?
That's okay. Representative Jensen. In relationship to this, as we're going through this, are we going to talk about any of the language in here? And I'm talking specifically in terms of the native salmonid populations.
Which line are you on?
I'm on either line 17 or line 25. on page 5-6 of the dash 2.
Go ahead.
Well, if we're going to stay with that specific language in here, we would understand that there's a certain considerable body of water and streams that are going to be excluded for time and all eternity from any of the activities that may take place as far as Ballot Measure 66 is concerned, and I'm referring at least to one being the Umatilla River above Three Mile Dam, where there is no such thing as native salmonid population anymore.
That's a good point. Does anyone have any concern about that? I mean, with the minute there?
Mr. Chair, I don't need concern, but if you keep going on the sentence, it says fish and wildlife habitat in the next line. So I think it includes native salmonid populations. I'm assuming this came out of the ballot measure.
That's correct.
Yeah. And it protection of native salmonid populations, comma, watersheds, comma, fish and wildlife habitats, and water quality in Oregon. So I think you can include all of those things in there. And
great.
I think we're stuck with it because it came with the ballot measure.
Understanding, you know, some of that, but there is a little difference between protection of the native salmonid population and go on and talk about fish and wildlife habitats.
Representative Morgan, did you have a comment?
Just a thought that the concern I would have about taking out native is that then you're talking about protection of all salmonid populations. And I'm wondering the effect that that's going to have on sport fisheries and commercial fisheries and those kinds of things.
Good point.
So, because that's in there, we may not have the option to add things to it.
Let's see if staff can help us sort this through. Did you have a comment, Jeanette?
So, but I think that there's a couple of things you can do here, or that this can be read, that the protection and restoration applies to that entire series of things, not just native salmonid, so that your protection and restoration would apply to native salmonids, watersheds, fish and wildlife habitats, and water quality. Does that help?
Representative Jensen, do you still have a problem with that?
Well, I still have a problem whether or not I'm going to be able to protect these salmonids that the Umatilla tribe have brought back to the Umatilla River.
Mr. Chair, Representative Jensen, if they're native, if they're fish,
okay,
then I think, yeah.
I believe we can agree.
That's the question. Co-chair. Mr. Chairman, I think Representative Jensen's point is well made because arguably, there were no coho stocks in certain streams that now have returning cohos that have been outplanted in that native fishery. So I'm not sure that the issue of native is such a small question. I think there may be a reason to look at that word.
Okay. And
I would understand the need to, stay true to the ballot measure as far as the wording there, but what I'm looking for is perhaps some wording that may allow us to go beyond that to protect some of the fish that salmonid populations that we have been able to successfully introduce.
Mr. Chair?
Senator Dukes and Representative Thompson.
If you take the word native out, I don't think fish and wildlife can go clubbing coho anymore out of the hatchery.
Mr. Chair, there's language later in under subsection 5 that describes the purposes of the monies and the protection, the restoration and protection subaccount. There had to be recognition of the language directly out of the ballot measure, and as we know, there were a number of things that were not totally clear with that language. But I think in establishing purposes of the sub-account, you can deal with perhaps a broader use of some of those purposes. So if you look under subsection A of section 5A, it talks more about watershed fish and wildlife.
Representative Thompson, could you?
Well, back to native. Is it defined in statute anywhere for defendants to locate bills, and I can't see it defined. So one of the first things it looks like to me we need to do is define native. It isn't. Is that right?
That's correct, Representative.
Anything that walks, swims, or flies, I mean, just.
So if we can define that, then we can start forward.
That's all.
Okay, Representative Jensen.
Mr. Chair, I'd be happy to move on with the committee recognizing that we've hit upon a snag here that we need to iron out and think about maybe before we do something with it. Just quickly, though, the one thing that bothers me in line 29 is the inclusion there then of other native species. You know, once again, the operative word coming in. So, but I would be comfortable with, you know, not holding this up at this point.
Okay. Can you help us work out a definition for that?
You don't pay me enough to do that.
I have a question, Senator Carno.
You note on line 17, page 6, it says protection of native Kalmata populations. Could we add language to that that read protection of native, wild, and non-hatchery Kalmata populations?
Mr. Chairman?
Okay.
I guess one of the keen frustrations I've had is the wild fish policy of the state of Oregon, which I think your amendment tries to deal with, the non-native populations. For instance, there's a lot of bass in the John Day River, and we've heard it proposed by the Department of Fish and Wildlife that fishery be poisoned out of the river. And that causes a little heartburn. And yet we've also got instructions about invasive species, and you can argue that some fish are invasive species too. But I would like us not to focus entirely on the wild fish issue, and I think the native question gets us right into that issue.
Okay.
So, Mr. Chairman, Representative Senator Turner, issue about non-native may be something that we need to discuss in our visit.
Non-hatchery. Or non-native.
Non-native.
Okay. I think we raised an issue. Let's give it some thought. Come back to it. Later, farther in section 8, Ken, would you like to speak to this, some of the definitions? And well, first of all, does anyone have any other issues on page 6 they'd like to talk about? Page 7. Let's, Ken, could you review our definition, or Jeanette, our definitions? And I think we've got pretty good consensus here, as I recall.
Mr. Chair, I think the definitions are pretty similar in both bills. Capital expenditures, this is kind of a bare minimum. The only thing I would add to not really the definition is that you might want to put on your list of things to talk about is whether you want to have any kind of criteria for whatever entity that awards the grants to you to help them determine whether a grant is a capital expenditure or a non-capital expenditure. Because you're not going to be able to anticipate every single kind of grant that might come before the commissioner board or whoever they are. They could do that themselves by rule, or it's just an issue of whether you want to define it in more detail in the statute or set forth the criteria for making that determination.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Question for Jeanette. We just passed the Hatchbox bill on the House floor today. Does it have a Hatchbox to qualify under the definition of capital expenditures?
Mr. Chair, I'm not a very good person to ask because I don't know enough about Hatchboxes. If they are a long-term improvement, probably.
Is there the reference to long-term improvement in this definition? If there is,
it's not. It's not in there. I guess that's the general understanding of what a capital expenditure is that I'm reading into this. Again,
if I could answer, Representative Starr. In my mind, that would be a capital expenditure. Just because it's portable does not mean it wouldn't be a capital expenditure.
I would appreciate it if it was more explicit in this bill, that specific item.
Representative Morgan.
In the dash 5, where is the definition of capital expenditure?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, you'll find in the dash 5, if you will look, in fact, on the front page, section 2, line 15 is the starting of the definition of capital expenditures in that. In that.
Mr. Chair, the dash 5s are more detailed than what's in the dash 2.
Representative King?
Line 7, on page 7, line 16, under 6A, expenses of research, design, and other technical requirements for the implementation of a project. Does that mean that if we wanted to do research that related to several projects, that would not be an appropriate expenditure?
Mr. Chair, Representative King, if the research was tied to particular projects, I think that you have less problem including it as a capital expenditure than research generally. For example, the IMST type of research on an issue.
I have a concern there that we might be more restrictive than what we're trying to be, since we can understand that some research probably does need to implicitly tie together several pieces of research rather than, a single project.
And I think I have the same concern. Are you suggesting that we could make that broader?
Pardon?
We could make that definition broader?
I think you have latitude to define capital expenses. I think that the farther you go from what is usually accepted as a capital expenditure, the more likely you're to be challenged on it. As meeting the intent of the constitutional provision.
And I guess as an example, I can make the same argument for engineering costs. If you're engineering for more than one project, wouldn't this be about the same type of situation?
If the engineering is to be applied to on-the-ground projects, then, and those projects are built or constructed, I think you have it's more reasonable to include it as a capital expenditure. If it's a research project to determine whether, a more general issue, then I think you have a problem. I think it's harder to justify that.
Let's go back to Representative Starr's example. If it's research to design a better hatch box or to figure out what how we get the best results out of a hatch box?
Mr. Chair, I think that if the research is for someone who's building a hatch box, for that hatch box, then yes, you're okay on capital expenditures. You may be okay on the broader issue of we need a better hatch box. What I would say is comparing this to when you're reviewing the rules of an administrative agency to see if they're within the intent and scope of your enabling legislation, that's precisely the kind of issue that we're faced with, and it's a matter of did the legislature intend this to include this kind of project? And the farther you go from what the common understanding was, the harder it is to justify it as being within the intent.
Mr. Chair? Representative King?
One of my concerns here on this clause is that we've had extensive dialogue about CEDA's research qualify as capital investment. I think we've been trying to put that in. And one of my concerns here is that this is really the enabling phrase. You know, when we use the word research, it says we can actually do something that has, you know, some research in it. And that if we use, you know, that, you know, our tool there where it's real restrictive, then maybe we, you know, can't use the tool to do some, you know, some things. I think that, you know, clearly we'd be able to do a project with some research. But I could see where we might have three or four different types of projects that might happen to be in line, and we need to figure out what's the cumulative impact, and that, you know, then we're dealing with projects in the research, and we're probably talking about the ability to put an S in on the word. I think what people are trying to accomplish here is not have us go out and do research on the entire ocean or something that's beyond the scope of what makes sense with the amount of funding we have here and are trying to keep some bounds on that. I can understand that. But I don't want to lose the ability to use research because it's too restrictive.
Let me try another example on that. It sounds like we're trying to pin down Jeanette. I'm just trying to get some understanding. Maybe another example would be we need some research to see what kind of net pens work well in an estuary so that we can properly fund projects in developing projects along those lines. Are you saying that it might be difficult to fund that kind of research through the capital expenditures?
Mr. Chair, I think you'd be safer funding it through the 35%.
Okay. Representative Morgan?
Would it make sense to tie this down maybe to define the projects as actual tangible things rather than, say, using that money to research if the moon had some impact on fish coming upstream or something like that? Have the research be tied to something actually taking place on the ground?
Mr. Chair, Representative Morgan, I think that would be helpful. As long as we didn't tie it I think some of the language allows less tangible things than a project to be funded. And that's, I mean, you don't want to tie a project as only capital expenditures, and yet it's the 65%. There's really two issues. There's what can be funded as a project, which is much broader, obviously, than the 65%, and then what can be funded as a capital expenditure is a subset of it.
I think we're kind of hung up here. Any other comments on that aspect of it? Maybe we need to digest sleep on this a little bit, but and also maybe we just don't have much leeway.
Pardon?
Also, maybe we just don't have much leeway to expand that.
Mr. Chair?
Senator Dukes?
It might be helpful at some point to define projects, because a number of these make references to projects, and if we know what a project, what the parameters are for a project, maybe that's the direction that Jeanette was talking about that we could give to the entity that it does this, but sort of see if they spend 65% on these things, or like the project, oh, and by the way, this is what a project is. And but not nail it all down, make it some parameters that they can use.
That's a good thought. Any other comments? Representative Johnson? Well, actually Judith was, and she left, so I'm adding on to the list. We're trying to. I think Jeanette is as well.
I have an input list.
Any other comments or questions on Section 8? If not, this evening, another chapter or section I'd like to go to is Section 18, dealing with the makeup of the Watershed Enhancement Board.
Mr. Chair? Are we all through with those sections in between 8 and 18?
No.
Okay. You'll be coming back to those?
Yes.
Thank you.
I'm just trying to pick the ones that I don't think we're going to need to spend, we need to do our homework on. Bear with me, I'm trying to find my own question. Page 17, is that where it is? Okay. Okay. We've had considerable discussion about the makeup of the board and also discussion that the tribe should be included and that the fishing interests should be included. Representative Morgan?
I also remember a discussion that particularly rang true with me, that if you limit the membership of the board to specific interest areas, that there's just by the very definition of doing that, you're going to be missing people out. And that it may be another way to look at this, to look at geographic representation or something that broadens it out, so that you aren't particularly excluding certain groups. And I think that there's some language in the dash 5 that deal with geographic representation, but I don't know where it is in there.
Mr. Chair, it's Section 8, and it begins on page 5 of the dash 5.
Senator Morgan, do you have this record? Okay. Mr. Chair?
While we're looking for that, one other option that was assessed, I'm not saying I'm espousing it, but for some of the same considerations that Representative Morgan stated, that by the time we start putting categories in, we end up excluding people, and then we have to include them, and you get up into the 20s or seats, that another approach is then to specify the number, and then ideally the appropriate part is just pointing people, typically we'll find people wearing multiple hats, and that you might end up with representation because someone might be a tribal person and also has a fishing background, for example, and that
that over time we get representation that way, and then we then get away from having obvious undefendable holes in the process.
I'm going to offer some thoughts on this. It would seem to me that what we're trying to do is get expertise on the board, and that if we went to geography or zones, that it would be very difficult to maybe get the very best qualified people to understand the grants and how the program works. I'm also concerned about too large a group, quite frankly. Too large a group, but I think that, you know, we're right at the max to be a functioning body. Representative Thompson?
I would like to add a little bit more. Ned and I have trained, and I've worked with a lot of commissioners, Department of Fish and Wildlife, and our Fish Commission. But you run into situations anytime you create a person who's designated from an area, and just like all of us, we soon become territorialistic toward the people that are involved, and you'll vote that way, and that worries me. Sometimes when you have a limited number where there's more players that want to be involved, you're better off by making at large positions that can be used, and most of the time they'll find their own level, and it keeps away from that having a specific designation. So it's just adding a comment.
Representative Stern.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. One option here is to be a little bit directive to the governor in his appointment to recommend that he be geographically diverse without actually being specific as far as X number of feet have to be from east of the mountain, or X number of feet have to be from the valley or whatnot. But just recommend or direct the governor to take that into account as he's appointing the members of the body.
Representative Morgan had her hand up.
I think that Representative Starr makes a good point that, and building on Representative Thompson's comment, that there must be a way to cross both over. One of the things that I'm very concerned about is that this is such a diverse state, and there is really virtually no part of it that isn't going to be touched by this piece of legislation. And it would be very, very important to have some assurances that there was going to be a geographically diverse representation of people as well as a diverse interest base directing this.
Representative Kerr.
Thank you. And at least in the Dash 2s, these folks would be subject to Senate confirmation, so there would be a continued legislative oversight, so to speak, of those appointees. If I'm holding any feet to the fire, if necessary, I'm not saying that we'd have to necessarily do that, but at least there's that opportunity as well.
Representative Carroll, let me point out that that's largely illusory, that you get one day, you can hold somebody's feet to the fire for 1 hour on one day, and then they never return your phone calls. Representative Jensen, the chair.
A comment on this, and I think in relationship to the geographic diversity, I think the perfect place for that is perhaps from the members of enough commissions get given here. Statute or some sort of language about it that these commissions represent the geographic members of from these represented geographic parts of the state, you know, would perhaps get us over some of that territoriality, because these people are already involved in some other activities. So, State Fish and Wildlife Commission, as an example. And when we get down into the rest of the members, Watershed Council, Conservation Districts, etc., yeah, I mean, we could expand this list on ad infinitum and never cover all of our bases. One of the things that I think is mentioned in some of the others that hasn't, you know, come here, but is the idea of city and perhaps a city elected official. And I don't know how it is in over in, you know, where all the people are at, but at least in my district, a number of the city elected officials are fairly actively involved in activities, and certainly are going to be needed in representation on it. But I'm not sure that the idea, we might even go with this entire list after the commission being at large without hurting the whole function of what was going on, are we to assume that the citizens of the state of Oregon are not going to be generally responsible people? They probably will be responsible if they're given the chore and the mandate. I think most of us, sure, and here we represent districts, but I think we try to represent the state of Oregon.
Representative Morgan.
Just one more piece to add to this, the board here, that the people that are actually on the ground doing the work of this whole process, the people in the soil and water conservation districts and the people that are in the watershed councils, I think should have a role to play in directing how this unfolds and facilitating the passage of the expertise and the money down through the system, and to have them have a place on the board, I think would add a real valuable perspective in keeping the whole thing kind of real grounded in what actually needed to be happening and what was working and what wasn't working out on the ground.
Sally, can I ask for a consideration here? Let's think about how many folks can work different proposals. In the Dash 2 amendments, what we have is an 11-member board who are voting. Dash 5 amendments, you have 11 voting members and 13 total. And I think it would be worthwhile for us to compare thought processes, at least evident from the membership, and see which one feels better. Senator Tarn,
sorry to butt in. Senator Dushler is a very valid point. The legislative appointees, we need to have two inside.
What?
Sorry, I mean, this is going quite tricky. She is the idea.
Actually, I noticed that myself when I sent it to you.
I'm not saying that there needs to be legislators on this group.
Yeah.
But if you go that way.
You need to have both parties represented. Representative Johnson.
I must rise in opposition. I represent more constituents in the state of Oregon than any other single legislator. 25% roughly of the people of the state of Oregon are non-affiliated. And I'm their only voice into the legislature.
I think I'm going to leave again.
You have the gavel, Mr. Chairman. Where are we? Actually, Mr. Chairman, I was just about to ask our colleagues here to consider the Dash 5 amendments because I think they, the folks that worked through this worked an awful long time to try and balance east-west and other stuff and compare that with the current makeup of the GWEB, which we just worked to add two more members to, which were the tribal interests, and figure out which of those approaches we like better. And we also have a proposal, at least, that would focus on the bipartisanship of the the bipartisanship of both houses, as my Senator Tarn was so redundantly repeated. The idea that we need, if we're going to have any legislators, that it has to be representative of at least the two current parties.
Chair.
Representative Thompson.
Well, Representative Jensen brings up a valid point. The way I got it here, this should be a tri-chair up here instead of a... be careful, you two.
Actually, I think you could call for volunteers and not get any. Senator Turner?
Is this way of clarification, there would be Section 8 of the Dash 5 Amendment. Is that correct?
Right.
Hold on, please, fire.
Right.
I'd like to raise one issue, and maybe you'd discuss it while I was out, and that is under the, where did I see it here? public at large, whether that should be maybe a local government individual as opposed to just general public. That's anything.
I'll follow up on that. I had another question as well, but I spoke with a representative from Portland. They were also interested in an urban person that was in the Dash Twos, be an official of a local government, as versus an urban resident. Could it be a local elected official from an urban area?
I'm not sure I would be in favor of making it that defined, but an elected official from either a city or a county, I think, would be appropriate.
And also, I shared with that person my concern that that I do want to get the best person there, but I do feel that it's a valid consideration that, for example, the city of Portland is putting together their own ESA, and they're putting forward millions of dollars, and they are one of the hot spots in the state in terms of solving some major problems, and we certainly want to respect the role that would play somehow.
Senator Jensen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And when we use the term urban, we'll get back to our previous topic about definition. And I think definitionally, urban constitutes a community of 2,500 or greater. For princess, et cetera, type of, that wouldn't specifically, address the metropolitan area's issue. And I would have to, recognizing Representative King's comments about the urban or the metropolitan area and the millions, perhaps, of dollars that they put in, would also suggest the millions of dollars worth of contribution that they have made to the pollution of the facility might also be an item of consideration there. But I think we do a real great disservice to some of the other communities in the state if we say specifically that Portland or Salem or this sort of thing needs a representative here and the rest of us really don't need to have one. And Mike, I would feel very strongly about that issue.
Right. I concur. And that's why I think urban is a better word than City of Portland, for example. In this context, can I get a point of order? I did step out, and my understanding was we were proceeding on. When I left, I thought I was working on Dash 2. When I come back in, I'm hearing Dash 5, so something happened, on the...
We're talking about the Dash 5 language, replacing Section 18 of Dash 2.
Mr. Chairman, in point of fact, what I said was there's 11 members enumerated in the Dash 2s. There are 11 voting members enumerated in the Dash 5s. And I just thought it would be valuable to compare how we can view the different geographic and political representations. It might be instructive to compare those side by side.
Okay. And to further the point of clarification, I pass the note forward. So I don't know, how far we've agreed to be working on Dash 2s or whether something else is out. Well, I think it will be helpful to know which ones they are, and I just got confused again, so maybe there's some point to that.
We're working on Dash 2s, but that doesn't mean that we can't use language from any of the testimony we've had,
right,
including Dash 5. Okay.
Thank you for clarifying.
Good night, Irene. Time to go home.
Saturday, you've got 25 more minutes.
Mr. Chair? How is the chairperson chosen now, GWA chair?
As I recall, it's appointee of the governor's office. Is that right?
Mr. Chair, Senator Dukes, it's the governor's natural resource advisor or a person appointed by the advisor.
I just noticed in the Dash 5 that The president, the speaker, and the governor.
Mm-hmm.
The governor, the president, and the speaker get to appoint the chairman. I remember watching that happen in some appointment in the last 2 years, and it seems to me it took us a very long time to get a person, and I don't know that this rises to that caliber of concern. I mean, if it's been working for the last 2 years, do we really need that? I guess that's my question about this whole thing. I prefer the twos. I can probably work on the fives for this issue, but it's sort of like I don't remember hearing a whole lot of complaints over the last 2 years about, especially once they got the regional review committees, about their board creation and makeup. Having a little trouble because we're further in some of these, and I don't know that we need to get the three of them into a summit to decide who needs to be the chair of this particular group.
Mr. Chair.
Go to.
I think the issue here, at least I have heard iterated several times, is that this actually does rise to the level of something as important as the IMFT, even. And that's the other, I think the big choice that we made with the IMFT and the interdisciplinary, or the, what is it, independent multidisciplinary science team, obviously was impaneled to deal with some fairly critical questions. I think in this case, the desire was to have somebody that was universally looked at as a balancing influence, somebody that would rise above politics, somebody that wasn't subject to the vagaries of whoever might be in the governor's office, so there wouldn't be a perceived control from whoever happened to be in the governor's chair if we were looking at the long term up through 2015. And that's the discussion that I heard attending to this issue. So.
Looking for goals.
Why?
Can you imagine that the executive branch, wherever they are, is going to get that excited about who's getting the grant?
Any more discussion? Representative Jensen?
If we're looking at the dash fives for this particular language, the one, among other concerns I might have, is the five of the voting members shall be the chairpersons of the following boards and commissions. First of all, if we talk about any kind of geographic diversity, that might not now be possible because the chairpersons might all be from one area. And secondly, the people who are the chairpersons of these otherwise boards or commissions, it's my expectation that their job in itself as the chairperson of that commission is going to be fairly demanding. And to take on this additional role while they're chairing those, unless they're retired or financially independent, may be more of a drain on the public than we'll be able to get people to do. I would be much more comfortable if we're going to use this language with just simply having a member coming from those various commissions. I don't know what the rationale of the folks were that were putting together for choosing the chairs, and I'd certainly be willing to listen to their arguments on that, but that's my feeling about it.
Or the designee of the chair.
Or the designee of the chair.
Language.
Or something of that type.
Representative Starr?
Yeah, if I could just comment on what you said, I think the designee would work as well. If we wanted to get to geographic diversity, I could suggest an amendment to the dash twos on page 17, line 17, that the six public members, and then insert after the six public members representing geographic diversity appointed by the governor, and you can just insert those three words, and there we're asking the governor that when he appoints these folks that they're from different parts of the state.
Okay. I'd like to comment on Representative Jensen's, the discussions I've had with at least some of the chairs of these commissions. You're absolutely right. They've got a huge job to do, and to designate them as the only ones to serve on this committee, I think would just simply not work.
As one of the former chairs, E2C, attorney from my district, I know he put an incredible amount of time and energy into that and simply wouldn't have had time to do this other job.
I think the other key part of the dash five that goes right along with that, it says that they would be approved by the Senate to serve on the GRAB board. And do you have discussion on that? Senator Turner?
I do think that it would be advisable or helpful to have members of our legislature involved in this committee, even if non-lawyers, to have an attending meeting just to stay in touch with what's going on. I like the idea of having a Congress.
Any other discussion? Representative Jensen?
Your point, Mr. Chair, I think is excellent. And if we stay with the existing language, the Senate really has very little option other than to get the governor to name somebody else as the chair of that commission. And if it's a designee of the chair of that commission, we get into a Senate refusing, and that's much more complicated than I think it is for the Senate to turn down an appointment of the governor than it would be of some some chair of a board or commission. So I think that these people have already been subjected, haven't they, to a Senate confirmation?
Yes.
And it would seem somewhat redundant.
Mr. Chairman, I think Jeanette has that on this one.
Correct. Mr. Chair, Representative Jensen, first of all, a comment. I believe chairperson is supposed to be a member. I think that's a mistake in the draft. But it's my understanding that these people who are on these boards who are also serving on this commission would have to be confirmed a second time as a member of this commission. And I believe that's the intent of the people who are proposed this version.
Mr. Chair?
Senator Bush?
Representative Jensen has some really great ideas tonight. It seems to me that if you want to go through such confirmation, it would be most productive to do confirmation of the public or the non-agency folks. Who an agency appoints, I guess we could get excited and say, oh, I don't like that particular commission member, but they've been appointed, they're on that agency, they somehow reflect that agency's perspective. So it might make sense to do the others, but so the way Senate has been handling confirmations lately, the question as to how effective it is.
Well, look at the issue of reconfirming people that have already been through confirmation one time.
Mr. Chairman, I think the reconfirmation issue was one that deserves consideration because if they were confirmed for a commission, they were not confirmed for a board, watershed council board. And so you're asking them to do essentially a completely different job. So you want to look at the qualifications and representation that person offers for a different job. It's not that they're doing the wildlife piece or the whatever commission they were originally appointed to. They are asked now to put on a much broader perspective. It isn't just the forestry person. It's now this grant application synthesis process that's quite a bit different than their specialty.
Representative Morgan.
Well, and having absolutely no familiarity with what the Senate confirmation process is, can you kind of give me the 15-second synopsis of what we're
unfolding? Mr. Chairman, there's this big dartboard in the back.
It's a dart
guy, too. Oh, the Senate confirmation process involves a hearing usually before the Rules Committee. And the resumes, the nomination is made, the governor makes an appointment. a file is presented on the background of the nominee to members of the committee. The committee holds a hearing, discusses the issue, asks for public input, and then makes a recommendation. And then the president schedules a hearing. The nomination comes on the floor. The nomination is debated and then voted.
And about how long does this generally take?
It can take 60 days to a couple of years. Right now there's a rather hot legal question about whether or not the governor may appoint a person who has failed in confirmation to the same position. The state attorney general says no. The governor says yes. So that's why one's been hanging for 2 years.
So just to follow up, one of the issues here then would be the speed with which this commission could be impaneled?
Generally speaking, what happens is the governor will send some fairly strong signals to the president of the Senate and others and ask about confirmation. One of the ways in which to avoid a lot of that difficulty is when you have to have the governor, the Senate President and the Speaker of the House agree in negotiations on a person they will all confirm. And that's the reason that at least the chair of this commission in the Dash Fives has a three-part nomination. In other cases, there are some flat disconnects. And then, you know, it could be fairly quickly done if there's consultation prior to the putting forward of a nomination.
So, again, to follow up here, having the Speaker and the President of the Senate and the Governor confer on who those people were up front could significantly speed up the process.
It could, but in the Dash Fives, I think there was only one nomination made in that way. In the normal course of the interim, you would have confirmation hearings not longer than 60 days apart. The Senate comes into session every 2 months to deal with confirmations and legislative e-board issues and other things. And so in the session, of course, you can have confirmation in a very short period of time. In the interim, it shouldn't be longer than 60 days between nomination and hearing. They get close? Not bad, huh?
Mr. Chair?
Senator Dukes.
I seem to recall, though, the last time we required the three to agree on the appointment, it took about 6 months to get the appointment out there and get everybody to agree on it. They exchanged lists, crossed a few off, and they made new lists when everybody got crossed off, and then they exchanged lists again, and it took a little while.
Mr. Chairman, that was because anybody nominated actually wanted to serve.
Well, this may be the same case.
Representative Kang and then Thompson.
Well, I think that is part of the issue, and that is one of my concerns here, is that yeah, they've been through it once. These are typically really, you know, high visibility people that have a lot of talent. We're really lucky to have them serving, and to ask them to go, you know, through it again isn't necessarily the best use of their time. But I would argue that even though this is a different commission, they are being asked to serve on that because of what they bring from, you know, from the board that they are coming from that they're already confirmed on, and that they probably have had discussion within their respective, you know, board agencies, et cetera, so that they can be the best representative of the perspective that comes, you know, from them. And so I think that, you know, someone that's already been confirmed isn't.
I think also, Representative King, that expanding the committee helps balance that out to where we've got a much larger committee. Representative Thompson.
I can ask this question of Jeanette. If I remember right, and there is several commissions that the wording, the person serves at the pleasure of the governor, is inserted in it and makes for removal. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, that Representative Thompson, that's correct.
Could you tell me which ones of our commissions are formed that way?
I can't tell you off the top of my head. I'd be glad to check it for you.
That is one subject that maybe at another point in time we could approach that subject, because it does change the criteria that these people serve under.
And Mr. Chairman, I think Representative Thompson raises a great observation and a great issue. Service at the pleasure of the governor could tend to make a sweeping change with a new administration possible with the letter. And I think the continuity of the commission was a real important factor, that you try to build continuity and that you try to build stability in decision-making on watershed issues that are so critical they have to last, you know, decades or longer. So I think that was an issue that was of real importance. The other thing is that in terms of the previous issue of the matter of double confirmation, I think the issue was that if you put in this statute on the dash A, that these folks would be subject to Senate confirmation, a previous confirmation doesn't count. It's a confirmation for this office. Unless we wanted to write some kind of an exemption into the statute for somebody who's serving on a current commission, who's in current term, who has currently been, or has already been previously confirmed. But I mean, you know, just by virtue of your nomination, you've got confirmation for life? I don't think so. I mean, so if we're going to have all the members subject to confirmation, then they would be subject to confirmation on each new appointment.
Any other discussion? Getting towards the end of our hour, I've asked my co-chair who's going to be chairing the next meeting to...
And I answered that it was Representative Mitchell who's going to be chairing the next meeting.
I just wanted to give the committee a heads up on the issues that we want to cover. And I would assume that we might want to recover some of the issues, some of the questions we asked. Co-chair's got circled section 1. These are dash 2s now. Section 1, section 3, and section 7.
Mr. Co-chair, those, in fact, are the key questions of who is the oversight agency, how does the agency director get appointed, and what are the duties of the agency? And I guess from my perspective, there's no point in us dallying further. We need to confront the question of what agency are we going to build. Are we going to designate an existing agency? Are we going to take an organization like GWEB that is not an agency and create of it an agency? Are we going to create a new agency, which in fact the commission's proposal would do? So we may as well confront those issues head on and figure out which direction we're going to go.
With that,
I just wonder if I could be allowed to throw out a concern I have. I'm not real sure that I understand or am I comfortable with why we've got an entire body of text in here having to do with the National Heritage Program. And I
could hear a lot of us have concerns about that.
Thank you.
With that, we'll adjourn until Thursday at 7 o'clock.